Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. In that war, we have seen some rather hotter moments of late, namely in Syria, where the United States military executed an extensive and expensive strike in the aftermath of what has been described as a chemical weapons attack on civilians by the regime of Bashar Assad. A man who knows a lot about chemical weapons, their use, their symptoms, and whether this happened in the case at hand is Dr. Lawrence Sellin. He is a retired colonel in the United States Army Reserves and, in fact, has been a branch-qualified officer and had assignments in the Army's Chemical Corps. His PhD, interestingly enough, is also in human physiology. He is the author of Restoring the Republic, Arguments for a Second American Revolution, and a very active contributor to the public policy debate, among other places, at the Daily Caller. It's great to have him with us from time to time. Colonel Doctor, welcome back. Good to have you.
Oh, thank you, Frank.
So give us your take on the assurances that we've had that indeed the evidence conclusively indicates the Assad regime was responsible for the chemical attack that precipitated the U.S. strike with its allies, Britain and France.
Yes. Well, let me give you a quick background on what's happened recently. There actually have been more than one previous alleged attacks of chlorine gas in Syria in the January-February timeframe. In fact, in March, Secretary of Defense James Mattis warned the Syrian government about this. Now, what was so special about Douma, where they responded and not to these previous attacks? Well, I think it has a lot to do with the images and videos that we saw coming out of Douma, especially, you know, involving children. Now, the problem is that the United States has no assets on the ground there. And if you read the White House report, which was the pretext of the strike that eventually occurred on April 13th, most of the evidence is coming from local sources, some of which are associated with the Syrian opposition. So you have to keep that in mind in terms of determining, you know, the value of the evidence, so to speak.
Do you also have some concern about the quality of the videos and photographs as well?
Yes, exactly. I looked at those images. I watched as many of the videos that I could get my hands on. And, you know, based on my experience, you simply can't tell by looking at those if a chemical attack occurred. And if so, what agents were used? There's some, of course, you know, based on previous alleged actions by the Syrian government, you can, you know, include that as part of your assessment. But if, in fact, as the White House report seems to indicate, they were basing it on this social media information that was coming out locally, you really can't tell because I looked at them, and they're also easy to fake.
Yeah, that's of concern. And so when you hear the Secretary of Defense, for example, say he is convinced that chemical weapons were used and that they were used by the regime, you're not so sure. And the strike, therefore, may well have been unwarranted, would you say, Dr. Sellin?
I can't say at this point it was unwarranted, but, you know, I do have doubts because if they use information that I was seeing, it's inconclusive. And I think the unless they have information that they haven't revealed.
Presumably that's the case. This is the U.S. government's sources and methods presumably would be brought to bear on this as well, right?
Well, this is the problem I also see is because many Americans have concluded that our intelligence agencies may be politically compromised. And I'm concerned about the possibility that maybe the president is not getting, you know, the full picture. So I'm worried that the launch may have been done without all the information we needed in terms of a pretext for the attack.
Okay. I want to ask you two related questions and ask you to answer them very succinctly if you can. Point one, any thoughts on the strike itself and the likelihood that it will deter this regime from engaging in chemical attacks in the future? And two, more broadly, about our posture and policy towards Syria at the moment?
Well, in terms of what they tried to accomplish, the mission was successful. We spent between $100 and $200 million hitting, destroying basically 9 buildings and a bunker. Now, so that was successful in terms of what they were trying to do, but it didn't eliminate Syria's chemical capability, and it won't change the course of the civil war at all. So those were not touched.
Because there's simply so much in the way of a chemical stockpile still in place in Syria? Is that your judgment?
Yes, and in particular, the means to deliver it when you're talking about aircraft, they're still there. Now, the other question you asked, which I think is also important, is the mission to destroy ISIS and prevent Syria from becoming a launch pad for attacks on the U.S. and its allies. Now, this is similar to what we're doing in Afghanistan, but in terms of the Taliban. Now, the problem with that is, and I see this as a micro strategy, the problem is that, you know, what is ISIS? It's not really an entity. What it is a brand or a franchise which individuals and groups tend to migrate to because of its notoriety. In the end, it's really just another form of Sharia supremacism. And we're never going to run out of those people because you have entire countries like Pakistan, like Iran, like Saudi Arabia, who are basically pursuing the same thing.
And they're doing it to some extent in concert with one another, even though there may be differences between them. You've been writing about what's going on in between Pakistan and Iran, for example, one a Sunni nation, the other a Shiite nation. Which, of course, belies the whole argument, which we've heard, well, it seems interminably since 9/11, even though 9/11 itself belies it, that these various strains of Islam can't cooperate to attack people like us, the infidels. And I take it you don't subscribe to that argument.
Not entirely, because I've been watching this carefully over the last year, and there has been a rapprochement between Pakistan and Iran. There's been a flurry of agreements, which seems to be encouraged by China. So I think not in all cases, like every country, not in all cases, they have mutual interests. And one of their mutual interests is the promotion of Sharia supremacy.
At our expense, needless to say. Dr. Sellin, we are hard out of time. Thank you so much for yours today. It's great to visit with you, and we look forward to doing so in the next week or two. Thank you for your service in Afghanistan and Iraq, as well as in the United States military more generally. Next up, we will speak with Diana West. We'll get her take on Syria, Korea, and judgment in Moscow. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined, as we have the delight to be each week, by Diana West, a longtime syndicated columnist and now a blogger par excellence at dianawest.net. She is the author of two terrific books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal, now available, American Betrayal that is, in an audio book. Terrific read, terrific listen, for that matter. Diana, it is so good to have a chance to talk with you. There is a lot on the plate at the moment, and I want to move through several things very quickly. But let me start with what I was just discussing with Lawrence Sellin, namely Your thoughts on Syria, the strike there, its justification, whether you feel that this departs from what President Trump campaigned on in terms of further U.S. interventions in the Middle East, or whether it was justified. Tell us what you think.
Yes, well, I'd be happy to. I've been thinking about this for some days now. And yes, I think it was a deviation from the program that President Trump outlined to the people repeatedly as candidate Trump in terms of disentangling ourselves from foreign entanglements over which we have little effect and do not line up in our list of American core interests, American strategic interests. And I feel that as president, he has been essentially enveloped by the Washington establishment inside the White House and, of course, the echo chamber around town. I think that in this particular, in other words, to continue in the way Washington has been behaving for generations now in terms of foreign involvement. But I think that in this particular case, it is such a strange event for President Trump to announce the withdrawal from Syria and then a week later to have reports that Assad has used chemical weapons in what the experts say is in a unique way, combining two kinds of gas that are not normally deployed at the same time. I can't explain that either. But I think that this was a provocation that was designed to draw President Trump in. And I'm sorry to say that he fell for it.
So you don't buy the argument that it is a core U.S. interest to prevent the proliferation or use of chemical weapons?
I think that it is. However, I think that in terms of the priorities in this particular case, I don't think that it actually does anything. The bad actors still have all their capabilities. We've seen it deployed recently in Britain, a chemical weapon. The supporters of the Assad regime and bad actors around the world still have all of their capabilities intact. I think that this was actually a setup. The concern in my view, strategically, is that it makes the United States an aggressor against a country that is not attacking the United States and not posing a threat to the United States' interests. Because of Russian support for Syria, a wider war is worth the good that can be done by destroying Syria's buildings where these things are developed.
I'm very concerned about the wider war as well, Diana, and I think that's a distinct possibility. But Diana, I do want to move along. The report just out that Mike Pompeo, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, slipped off to North Korea in a covert diplomatic mission during the Easter holiday to meet with Kim Jong-un. We've now had President Trump describing this as a good meeting, that a good relationship has been forged. You've studied communists for a long time, and we'll talk more about that in a moment, but just your thoughts on what's being teed up here in terms of a meeting with arguably one of the most horrific communists of all time, Kim Jong-un.
Yes, and again, a beneficiary of sponsorship from Russia and China. Again, I'm afraid that we're looking at provocations. We're looking at setups here. Americans who reach high office, presidents and others of that level, across history, generally think that they, as personalities, can do things one-on-one that no one else can do. And I think that this is an appeal to vanity and other weaknesses that have plagued our policymaking, certainly going back to the Roosevelt days in terms of Roosevelt believing he could deal one-on-one with Stalin and emerge victorious, which, of course, was a complete provocation and setup also. So this concerns me greatly, given the long history, given the strategic ambitions of our adversaries and enemies. So I am, you know, with these initial reports, I am extremely skeptical.
Yeah, I'm skeptical of this symmetry. I agree with you. Yes. There is this tendency to believe that somehow the personal chemistry between leaders is going to eliminate or at least alleviate a lot of abiding problems. And this brings me to the subject of your book, American Betrayal. Diana, you've delved into the phenomenon of, well, what I think Samuel Johnson called the triumph of hope over experience. you know, with these characters. You've also written about in your blog, DianaWest.net, an interesting effort by another student of history and, well, actually a significant player in history at the critical moment in the Soviet Union's demise, Vladimir Bukovsky. His book, Judgment in Moscow, apparently is finally going to be published in English. Tell us a little bit of the backstory there, about the book itself, what it chronicles, and why on earth it has taken all these years, decades, to finally have it available to the rest of us who don't speak Russian.
Yes, well, the book was originally contracted by Random House to come out in the mid-1990s. It has come out in many different European languages, and I believe also in Russian as well. But we do not have a copy. We do not have an English edition until later this year. And the reason for that was that Random House broke the contract when Bukovsky would not rewrite the book. And as he told Random House, he has his personal biography, in other words, a dozen years in KGB prisons and psychiatric hospitals, makes him allergic to censorship. But essentially, the story that people don't want to hear is what he discovered about the corruption and collusion, to use the word in its real sense, of the Western powers, of the Western elites with the Soviet project. I mean, essentially, this is what comes out of the archives of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, which he was allowed to enter on the say-so of then-President Boris Yeltsin, who initially was convinced to perhaps put communism on trial, a la the Nuremberg trials after World War II. This was Bukovsky's driving ambition when he returned to Russia in 1991 to do this very thing.
A brief, and it turned out very short-lived, sentiment on the part of Yeltsin's. I think probably having something to do with the rise of Vladimir Putin in Yeltsin's circle, don't you think?
What Yeltsin showed Bukovsky was great concern and opposition to such a trial coming from the West. Western governments were informing him that they would not look kindly on such a revelation of what happened between the West and the Soviet Union.
Lest it expose their misdeeds.
Yes, which is essentially where you see the correlations to American betrayal, which does delve into these same collusions, these same collaborations between the West and, in those days, Stalin.
This brings me to a point that's very much current. As you know, we spoke of Mike Pompeo a moment ago. He is, of course, the president's nominee to be the Secretary of State. He has been attacked rather viciously, I think it's fair to say, by some on the left and some among the Sharia supremacist camp, shall we say, for having, among other things, appeared on this program, but having a rather different view of what this Sharia doctrine is about than we're supposed to have. And it seems to me that the effort to suppress the kinds of conversations that we have with you each week and others, of course, in all of these subjects, is redolent of the kind of campaign that we've just been discussing with respect to, you know, the communist history and Western submission to it. Could you just quickly connect those dots for us, Diana?
Yes, and I think that's a great point, because I should also mention that in Bukovsky's case, or in Yeltsin's case, the idea of trying communism, exposing the doctrine and what it did to millions and millions of people, was also opposed not just by Western governments, which was the very shocking opposition, but also the establishment in Russia, in the former Soviet Union as well. And that's where you get the same behavior, the same patterns that we see here, in the sense of essentially trying to suppress, repress, censor discussions of the truth about Sharia, the truth about Islamic expansionism, the collusion of and corruption of our the people who have sworn to uphold our liberties and our constitution.
Our elites, our establishment, the list goes, the journals.
And they behave the same way. And this is what we're seeing in terms of Mike Pompeo being attacked for coming on a radio show with you, of all people, to discuss the great events and dangers of our time. So this is just more of that same kind of establishment effort to suppress the truth and ultimately suppress our freedom. And it is the greatest danger of our time that goes back certainly a century now.
It's very much worth studying how it has happened to this point. And I think nobody's done it better, really, than you and your terrific book, American Betrayal. Come back to us again next week, Dinah. We will have more to discuss in all of these departments, I'm sure. But thank you for the work you do. And please, folks, check out both Dinah's books as well as her terrific blog, dinahwest.net. Next up, we'll speak with Joe DeGeneva about rot in the FBI and the Department of Justice and what we best do about it right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's a pleasure to say we are joined by Joe DeGeneva, one of the great legal minds and, for that matter, practitioners of our time, a man who has not only served as a U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia, but also as a special counsel among various other counseling he's been doing, including to several Senate committees, investigatory and otherwise. He is an extraordinary resource on matters that have become now so front and center in our polity that he's much in demand. We're very grateful to him for taking a few minutes to share some of his thoughts about what's afoot at the moment, in particular, some of the institutions that we rely upon to keep us safe and free. And I just want to say, Joe DeGeneva, thank you for the work that you do tirelessly beyond your legal practice. It seems you have a full-time job on the various airwaves, and it's so incredibly important to all of us. So thank you again.
Sure. My pleasure.
So let me ask you, speaking of this rot, it does seem to me that one of the really important contributions to exposing it has been Michael Horowitz's report. He is, of course, the Inspector General of the Department of Justice. Both in the FBI and in the department itself, what did you take away from that report, Joe?
Well, the report is stunning in its unequivocal conclusion that the assistant director over there, Mr. McCabe, lied repeatedly, both under oath and in unsworn testimony to the IG and the FBI.
Now, you mean he was less than candid?
A particular euphemism that the government likes to use when it is reporting about its own people rather than the citizenry. Now I know why Madame Defarge knitted a lot when she was watching people being hung and on the guillotine. The IG report is, in fact, a roadmap to what is coming down the pike about Mr. Comey and the senior DOJ officials who purposely took a dive on the Hillary Clinton email server case. It is symptomatic of how the Obama administration politicized not only the FBI and the Department of Justice, but the CIA and the Director of National Intelligence, Mr. Clapper. I suspect that Mr. Clapper, Mr. Brennan, Ms. Lynch, Sally Yates, Mr. Comey, and others will find themselves in front of a federal grand jury sometime within the next couple of months, run by Mr. Huber, the U.S. attorney from Utah.
Who is picking up the portfolio, apparently. In the absence of something that you've called for, Lee Zeldin and others have on Capitol Hill, Mark Meadows, Jim Jordan, which is a second special counsel, one that would operate in parallel with Bob Mueller's investigation, but look into, among other things, this obvious scandal with respect to Hillary Clinton, her emails, and other malfeasance. Talk to us about the importance of that as an alternative to having a U.S. attorney do this investigation, Joe DeGeneva.
The presumed purpose for appointing a special counsel is because there's some sort of conflict of interest inside the department, political, personal, whatever, that requires someone not in the DOJ hierarchy to conduct the investigation. At this point, I'm perfectly satisfied to use Mr. Huber, the U.S. attorney for the state of Utah, to conduct the preliminary investigation to determine whether or not more special counsel is necessary. I actually am somewhat agnostic on this at this point, because the special counsels, in my view, of course, have become a renegade, the operation, Mr. Mueller. This is disgusting what has occurred over there, with no crime ever having been posited by Mr. Rosenstein in his appointment memorandum. They have expanded into areas that they have no business being in, and that but for the appointment of Mr. Mueller, no one would be looking at. And it seems to me the but for test is the most important one of all. And I think that is why the president is mad about the raid on his lawyer's office. And he has every reason in the world to be furious about it.
Yeah. Well, as obviously you have said, the Mueller example is one that causes some trepidation about the idea of setting up another one. And if you're comfortable with the U.S. attorney carrying this forward for the time being, then I certainly feel better about it. Speaking of Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, Joe, talk a little bit about these charters to the special counsel, Bob Mueller. There are two of them now, it turns out, and one seems to have been engineered after the fact. To what effect?
What happened was, Mr. Mueller was appointed by Mr. Rosenstein in a fit of pique, apparently, that he didn't like the fact that president had been on television interviewed by Lester Holt and said that one of the reasons he fired Comey was over the Russian probe. So apparently Mr. Rosenstein felt harmed or betrayed by that, and so he decided to appoint a special counsel. It shows you how weak-kneed Mr. Rosenstein is. Mr. Rosenstein is a classic Bush apparatchik type. Step on the little people, climb up, get your job, move on to the next one. And all he's ever wanted to be is a federal judge. I predict that will never happen in his case. The other thing that happened after the appointment of Mr. Mueller was that they did a mafia-style raid on the home of Paul Manafort in the early morning hours, a no-knock warrant, so they could knock down the front door of Paul Manafort's home in Virginia and roust Mr. Manafort and his wife, both of whom were either nude or in pajamas, to be physically searched by FBI agents. This is one of the most outrageous abuses of federal law enforcement power in history, and it will ring in the minds of many people as they go back and look at whatever it is that Mr. Mueller produces as a terrible abuse of power. We now know that that raid was conducted before Rod Rosenstein expanded Mr. Mueller's authority to investigate, and that secret order allowing him to investigate this part of Mr. Manafort's life, which did not relate to Russia or to the campaign, that secret order was purposely not made public to help Mr. Mueller fight legal proceedings about the lack of legitimacy of his investigation. The fact that Rosenstein kept that expansion of authority secret shows you how rotten Mr. Rosenstein is to the core in terms of his own integrity. He's another Comey style, I'm the only righteous man in the room kind of guy, and I can assure you he is anything but.
Yeah. So you had both after the fact butt covering deal, and it was withheld from public scrutiny. You've called very explicitly, Joe DeGeneva, for the firing of Rod Rosenstein. I'm anxious to have you explain, in the circumstance in which the attorney general is recused, who would that result in being the overseer of Mueller? Would it resolve to a deep state apparatchik somewhere in the bowels of the bureaucracy? And doesn't that give us reason for concern as well?
I'm really glad that you've asked that question. I am of the belief that Jeff Sessions should fire Mr. Rosenstein, not the president. And the reason is very simple. It is quite clear that Mr. Rosenstein has developed an animus toward the president of the United States, and that he is acting in a fit of pique for whatever reason. As I said, he's a bit of a martinet, and he considers himself pristine like Mr. Comey. It is now imperative, I think, that he be removed from office, because I don't believe he has the best interest of the Department of Justice at heart. And I think that I agree with Alan Dershowitz that I think Jeff Sessions should unrecuse himself with regard to any part of the Mueller investigation that has nothing to do with Russian collusion. For example, that would be the case in New York against Mr. Cohen. I do not expect Mr. Sessions to do that, because at this point, poor Jeff is afraid of his own shadow. So that's not going to happen. So I would not seek Rosenstein's removal right now. I would wait until some other people in the department are confirmed who are being held up in the U.S. Senate by Democratic obstinance. And once they're confirmed, whoever is confirmed, by the way, by the United States Senate for the Justice Department can move into the deputy's office immediately, because as long as they're confirmed by the Senate, they can hold any position in the department that's needed.
Question, Joe, I've lost track of this. I thought that one of the people who was holding up Justice Department appointees was actually a Republican by the name of Cory Gardner of Colorado. Has he lifted his holds?
He has. He got a deal with the White House over not going crazy over pot sales in Colorado. He's a very happy man now, and he has taken the holds off of DOJ personnel.
Let me ask you, speaking of this thuggish kind of approach on the part of Bob Mueller, would you assign the same characterization to this instance of Michael Cohen's raid, that is to say the raid of his hotel room, the raid of his home, the raid of his office, and what has flowed from it?
It's in terrorem use of federal law enforcement power, and it's really unnecessary.
For the Latin challenge, that would be terrifying use?
That's right. Yes. In the 1960s, the Justice Department, when it was conducting anti-war grand juries around the country, would subpoena people and make them all come to Washington, D.C. at great expense. And that was called an in terrorem tactic. And that is exactly what this raid on Michael Cohen's office was. It was absolutely disgusting, unnecessary, and was designed to send a signal to all cooperating people, to any potential witnesses, and more specifically to the President of the United States, that he had better watch out. And I must say, I think it is unbecoming. I was appalled by it. And I don't care what the justification for it is. I don't care what the evidence is against Mr. Cohen. You can conduct a criminal investigation of Mr. Cohen without this thuggish raid on his office, his hotel room, and his residence.
And Joe, very quickly, are you concerned about the implications of this kind of practice for the attorney-client privilege more generally?
I am, because what happens is, once this gets going, and once you've established a precedent that you can do this in a case that doesn't require it, these kinds of raids are usually used on the offices of the consigliere for the mob, or for the drug dealers, or terrorists. To use it in a case like this sends a horrible, horrible signal to clients, their lawyers, and others, that the Justice Department may willy-nilly do this tactic, and it's absolutely outrageous in a potential white-collar crime case like this. And remember, Mr. Rosenstein personally approved this raid. For that alone, he should be fired.
Later, it seems, though, not quite yet. Judge Geneva, thank you for walking us through so many of these complex matters. Your clarity as well as your mastery of the subject matter is both impressive and appreciated. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon. Frank Calzone joins us next to talk about the death of Castro's.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by Frank Calzone, a freedom fighter for decades to try to help liberate his homeland, the nation of Cuba, from the tyrannical misrule of the communist Castro regime, initially Fidel, more recently Raul. It's coming to an end, thanks be to God, with a handoff of power, apparently to Fidel Castro's brother's chosen successor, Miguel Díaz-Canel. To talk about that and what the implications are for the people of Cuba, for U.S.-Cuban relations, and more generally, I'm very pleased to welcome a man whose expertise on these subjects I have long valued. Frank Calzone, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for the work that you do on the Center for a Free Cuba. Tell us what you make of the end of the Castro era, at least nominally. Is it a time to take stock of the legacy?
First of all, thank you for having me. There's no end of Castro's rule in Cuba. This is simply a PR effort by the dictatorship to try to present the regime in a different light in order to get more governments to forgive the millions of dollars that Cuba has not paid and to get additional money, assistance, investment from abroad. What you're seeing is more of the same. The Cuba under Raul Castro for the last few years after he was selected, after he inherited power from his brother Fidel, has had two major components. One is repression at home, misery at home, and anti-American foreign policy abroad. And that is not likely to change. Díaz-Canel has no basis of support whatsoever in Cuba. The elections in Cuba, or what they call elections, are not something that Americans would recognize as such. What happens is that the Cuban people are supposed to vote to elect, and they already did, 605 deputies to the assembly, to the National Assembly, of a list of candidates that's exactly the same number.
And all selected by the regime, right?
They all selected by the Communist Party. And it is the Communist Party where Raul Castro will remain the head after Díaz-Canel becomes the chief of state. This is, by the way, not unique to Cuba. During the Stalinist period in the Soviet Union, there were different heads of state, but the power always remained on the hands of Joseph Stalin, who was the General Secretary of the Communist Party. The Díaz-Canel has no support, for example, in the economic sector. He's been a party worker, functionary all his life. The economy is under the control of a general, Luis López Calleja, who is a former son-in-law of Raúl.
Which speaks to the role of the military in the economy as well as maintaining the regime in power.
And of the family. The other, besides the party and the economy, of course, there is the security service, the spy agencies abroad, the repression police at home. A very important official in that ministry is his son of Raul Castro, who is a colonel in the Cuban military, and who was the person, not the new president, but this son of Raul Castro, Castro's spin, was the man who negotiated with the United States the arrangement with Mr. Obama.
Yeah, Ben Rhodes' operation in the Obama administration, right. So you've I think made pretty clear that Raul may be changing station, but the family, as well as the institutions they dominate, will continue to exercise control. It will remain, Frank Calzone, a police state. Is there any chance that the suffering of the Cuban people and the lack of any particular legitimacy by Díaz-Canel may result in change? And if so, what should the United States government be doing to try to help bring that about?
Well, there are two things to keep in mind. One, it is true that the old guard remains in power, whether they have a younger Díaz-Canel as president of Cuba. When Raul Castro became president, there were some in the United States who kept talking about how Raul was younger than Fidel was. Raul was younger, 3 or 4 years younger, so it didn't matter that much. In this case, the process that got Díaz-Canel where he is today had nothing to do with the discussion of the future of Cuba, with when the hurricane a few months ago created great suffering in Cuba, neither Díaz-Canel nor Raúl Castro went to see those poor folks. Canel did not make any promises during the last year about changes in Cuba or what he would do if it were to be a president of Cuba. The Cuban people continue to wait for the promises that were made by Raúl Castro when he became president.
Yeah, the so-called reformer, right?
Yeah, but Raúl said things that were very specific to the daily life of Cubans. He said that his goal was to have a Cuban be able to drink a glass of milk every day. Well, they're still waiting for that. Raúl also said that in the economic sector, Cuba has three currencies. Dollars, another is hard pesos, and the soft pesos, which are what Cubans could pay. Cubans could pay the equivalent of $24, $25 a month. And when they go to the hard currency store where they can get things to eat that cannot be found in the rationing card, they have to pay in hard dollars, which is like paying in American dollars. So you get you got $25 a month, and then you got to go and buy soap and oil, cooking oil and a couple of other things. That's it. Your money is gone. Now, Raúl promised to change that. He didn't. Díaz-Canel, and now it's obvious what he did. A video in which he was talking to the Communist Party leadership months ago, in which he clearly expressed himself as a hardliner, criticizing the United States, saying that Cuba has to remain the course, so on and so forth. So it is not likely that anything is going to happen. As a matter of fact, the cabinet and key positions in the government more than likely will be selected by Raúl Castro. Díaz-Canel has no input into any of that.
You know, Frank, I think you're almost certainly right. I do expect, though, there will be a charm offensive launched to try to make it look as though this is the great white hope and see if they can't, as you say, pull in the life support and legitimacy from this country as well as Europe. But standing in the way, at least in part, for the United States, and I'd like to just quickly ask you to finish with this, what's the latest on the attacks on American diplomats by the Cuban government?
The Canadian government 2 days ago announced is withdrawing all family, all dependents out of Cuba because some Canadian diplomats and dependents were also injured. There are two things that to keep in mind. One, there's a new generation of Cubans now who know a little bit more about technology, know a little bit more about the internet, and they are obviously publicly pressing on the government. 15 Cubans, university students and teachers, were expelled from the university this last year. Secondly, the foreign policy of Cuba will remain the same. Cuba is a close ally of North Korea, of Syria, of Iran. Cuba has a military contingent in Venezuela. I would hope that the White House and other governments would tell Díaz-Canel that he has to remove, at the very least, remove the Cuban. The thousands of Cuban officers who are in Venezuela repressing the Cuban people as a condition to have normal business.
That's a very important point. It's a twofer because it might actually help bring down the regime that they're propping up in Caracas. We have to leave it at that, Frank Calzone. There's so much more to talk about. We'll be back to you shortly after this change of power, such as it is, takes place. But I thank you for your analysis as well as the work you've done over your life to try to bring about truly a libre Cuba. Thank you, my friend. To the listeners, I hope that you'll be joining us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.